Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice. Our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Well, welcome everyone. It's Dr. Zafiridis. Welcome. Welcome to The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much for sticking with me over the last few weeks. It has been so busy. February was a blur. I think, the biggest speaking schedule month of probably my career. It was so busy. I had a great time. I think I reached a lot of people over the last month, but it was quite busy. It really limited what I could do for the podcast. Just ran out of time during this past month, but I am back with the show. This is episode 99, almost to 100 episodes of The Healthy Mind with Dr. Zafiridis. Thanks to all of you for supporting me in the way that you do, telling people about the podcast, maybe tweeting about it, or just sending me an email. I really do appreciate it. I have a great program for you today. It's going to be, well, it's going to be a little bit of me getting up on my soapbox, but it really is an important podcast today. We're going to be talking about some pretty serious subjects, and hopefully I don't make it too heavy for you, but we're going to be talking about suicide, homicide, and the tragic consequences of stigma about mental health and stigma about mental illness. It was stimulated by a discussion that I had last week in one of my sessions, and I'll tell you about it here as we move on in the program, but it had me thinking, and I really want to spend some time really sharing the statistics that are out there on the devastation that can come from depression and anxiety when it leads people to feeling desperate, and some of the things that we can do to hopefully make it easier on people. It's not going to be too clinical of things that we can do, but things that all of us can do to make people realize that they're valuable, that they're meaningful, that they matter, so that they don't get that desperate. It's one of my biggest passions, is trying to spread the word about mental health and eliminating or trying to decrease the stigma that gets in the way of people being happy. For some people, it can get in the way of literally being able to live. So there's a lot on the line here when we're talking about eliminating stigma. In the news, wow, some amazing new research that took a look at probably one of the most common pain relievers that you have right now in your closet, without a doubt, in your medicine cabinet. You might even have it in your briefcase or your backpack or your purse. Can this medication cause ADHD? Can it cause ADHD? We'll talk about that in the news. And also, oh gosh, parents, I know as a parent of three, I know that we do our best to teach our kids to read. But how much are we really expecting that they are going to be able to pick up? Are babies really able to learn despite everything that we do? Do they really learn or not? I'm going to answer that question for you. We're going to do some headlines. We've got ourselves a pretty good podcast. I am so happy that you are here today. So if you're ready, Let's begin. Okay, well, you know, one of my hopes here with the podcast, one of the biggest hopes that I have with the podcast is that hopefully just in getting to know me, hearing me, that maybe it changes some minds on what psychiatry is, on what a psychiatrist or what people believe a psychiatrist is, or how we deal with mental illness, emotional illness, and trying desperately to decrease the stigma that is involved in mental health and mental illness. And it came up, and you know, it was a culmination. It wasn't just this one person in one of my sessions last week, but it happens, and it really just kind of sparked me to put this podcast out there. But it's someone who's been struggling with depression, and we've gone through some medications and therapy. But the part that really stimulated me to think about this further was he came in, and actually before that, others came in, and people apologized to me. They apologized to me because they are not feeling better. I'm sorry, Dr. Z. I wish I could give you better news. I'm sorry, but I still feel depressed. I mean, come on. Why are people apologizing to me? This is what I do. Do you go into your primary care doctor and say, oh boy, I'm really sorry, but I still have diabetes. I'm really sorry. I still have high blood pressure. Of course not. Of course not. No one is going to do that. I mean, it's one thing if you're not taking care of yourself and maybe you haven't done some of the things that you should do to improve your health. But people don't go in and apologize for medical illnesses. But it happens here. And I think it speaks to the stigma, the double standard that is still there when we're talking about emotional illness, mental illness. The fact that it's still hard for people to really accept that there is some biological relevance. There's a biological condition here that causes people to feel depressed or anxious. We may not know where it comes from. We may not be able to cure it with the treatment that we have, but we can treat it. And that really isn't much different than any other medical issue. High blood pressure, we don't know where it comes from. The bulk of people just have it. We can't cure it. All we can do is treat it. Diabetes, we don't know where it comes from. Yeah, genetics, but the same can be said for depression. We can't cure it. We can treat it, and people can have a good quality of life. Now, both for hypertension and for depression, the answer isn't just a pill. Take this pill, go ahead and keep smoking. Take this pill, keep eating as much as you want. No, it isn't how it works. Take this pill, exercise, control your stress, eat right, sleep well. It is a complete approach to taking care of yourself, whether it's hypertension or diabetes, but it is the same in depression, anxiety, and other emotional illnesses. It isn't just the medications. That's just part of it. In fact, I like to look at it as a smaller part of the picture. But therapy can be important. Watching the stress that you are under and trying to eliminate it or decrease it, taking the time for relaxation, eating well, sleeping well. I hope you're starting to see that there's a very clear consistency here with depression, anxiety, and the emotional illnesses, and any other major illness that we are struggling with as a nation. And like these other illnesses, depression, anxiety, bipolar, all these emotional illnesses carry a risk. They carry a risk. And that risk is there's a real mortality to these emotional illnesses. And not just suicide. One can understand with depression, how do people die? Unfortunately, too many of them end their own lives in the form of suicide. But what's really important here is that it isn't just in the emotional futility and darkness that leads a person to end their lives that depression and other emotional illnesses can have an impact on our health. I've talked about this before here on the podcast, but we have many large studies, both here in America and across the world, that have looked at the increase of disease burden, like diseases such as hypertension or diabetes or cancer or inflammatory illnesses. The disease burden, the increase of suffering that you have, the worsening of those conditions when you also have depression and anxiety is huge. It is huge. And the risk of death by all causes, not just suicide, but of all causes, hypertension leading to stroke or to heart attacks or to cancer, increases dramatically if you also carry a diagnosis of emotional illness. So I hope that people begin to see that what we're talking about here in the treatment of these disorders is very real, is very biological, and it has huge implications. The treatment isn't just so that you can feel better, feel happier. That's an important part, the largest part. But we are only now, and I mean the last 15 to 20 years, beginning to understand what are the implications physically of not treating properly depression and anxiety. And it is huge. So stigma gets in the way. We still have a double standard when it comes to emotional illness, to mental illness. I love the example that I had heard back a few months ago at a conference. Someone said, you know what? If we knew during, say, the campaign season when someone is running for president, that that particular individual had hypertension or diabetes, no big deal. No big deal. Probably wouldn't influence our decision on who we vote for. But if that person had an emotional illness, depression, bipolar, would we really vote for him? Would you really vote for him? And I think right there is where we see the stigma that is still there. And I really want to emphasize that it is tragic. And I say it's tragic because the consequences of stigma are lethal. And I've said this before here on the podcast, stigma kills. It kills. Because people feel bad. People feel bad about going in and talking to someone about this. Their depression, their anxiety, they're embarrassed. They don't want to be seen as weak or less than or crazy. So they avoid treatment and they become more isolated, and it spirals and spirals. And there's been a lot of high profile cases, both of suicides, but also of homicides in the news. Individuals who really, if you look at these stories in which an individual goes out on a rampage or a spree and kills a bunch of people, ultimately it ends in either them taking their lives or the police taking their lives. More often than not, these are suicide missions. A person is ending their life. That's going to be what happens. But they also take others with them. And there's a huge concern in America about how do we decrease the risk of this? How do we find these individuals, these troubled people, these evil people, they've even been called? They've done terrible things, evil things. I'm not trying to minimize or cast them purely as victims. It's tragic. But I think a lot of it goes to the sense of isolation, to the sense of alienation that festers and burns when people feel so alone and not part of this world. And I'm not saying that stigma is the reason that these acts are happening. But certainly when we hesitate, when we are worried, when we reinforce that really you don't talk about these things in public. It's 2014, but don't talk about your depression. Don't really talk about your anxiety or bipolar. There are many, many consequences that we have to reconcile. The most tragic that those of us in the field deal with is suicide. And it's terrible. I recently lost another patient to suicide. Just horrible. And it isn't just that the person is gone, but it affects the family. The consequences of that for the family and what they have to carry is just so terrible. It's so terrible, and so often it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And believe me, I am not trying to minimize the pain that people are feeling, but oftentimes that desperation isn't where people live 100% of the time. Just is tragic. And I want to share some of this with you to get an idea of how bad this is in at least our country here. 30,000 Americans commit suicide every single year. 30,000. And it's the third leading cause of death for individuals 15 to 24 years of age, and the second cause of death for individuals 24 to 35 years old. The second leading cause of 20-year-olds and early 30-year-olds. Now, I just ask you, if this was a virus, if this were some other problem, a cancer that affects 15-year-olds to 30-year-olds, and it's either the second or third leading cause of death, what do you think we'd be doing as a nation? I think there'd be a ton of awareness and a lot more focus on really eradicating the problem. We've done a lot. Awareness has saved lives, but we've got a long way to go. It's important that people realize that particularly for 20-somethings, it's the second leading cause of death, suicide. And what's tragic about it is 2/3 of the people who end their lives are depressed at the time of their deaths. Depression that is not treated, that is not diagnosed or poorly treated, is the number one cause of suicide. The number one cause of suicide. Poorly treated, undiagnosed depression. And this, for me, is a statistic that really grabbed me. And I want you to consider this. More teenagers and young adults die from suicide than they do from cancer, heart disease, AIDS, birth defects, stroke, pneumonia, influenza, and chronic lung disease combined. Combined. And finally, 4 out of 5 teens who attempt suicide have given clear warning signs. Now, it isn't just the stigma. There is a question of access. People who are depressed, individuals who are depressed, teens, adults, elderly folks who just don't get there. There's not enough mental health professionals. There's not enough psychiatrists and therapists and nurse practitioners out there. It's a complex issue. But it is so important that we begin to change the conversation and make it even more comfortable than it is now to talk about these issues, to make people realize in our small way that they matter, that they truly matter, that they exist. So what do we do? What can all of us do to decrease the stigma, to try and make a difference in helping individuals who may be embarrassed or ashamed or feel like they don't matter. Well, I saw something so beautiful, and I wish I could remember where it was. If any of you know, please email me at peter@thehealthymind.com. There was a story of a teacher who tried to help out with this issue of these troubled teens who at some point may get so desperate that they go out and kill. In her small way, she would take individual students and have them get to know each other, and then later on, if I remember this correctly, later on in the class or in the year, would rotate students so they were forced to talk with everyone in the class so that no one got too isolated. And I don't think that this is something that only has to be isolated in young people or in school-aged children. We can all do this. We can all take a small moment to smile, to say hello, to not keep our head down or in our phones or our tablets, and realize that we're all part of this fabric. It's so important that we talk to each other and to be able to talk about these feelings, even if they are uncomfortable. A lot of times people will ask me, is it okay to ask someone if they're all right, if they're even thinking about ending their life or even talking about suicide? Is that going to give someone the idea? No, it isn't. Quite the opposite. And there is a ton of data behind this. Talking about it oftentimes helps the person to diffuse the situation because it's not something they can talk about. But being able to give a person the ability to talk about it, that it's okay, that it doesn't mean that you are crazy or that you have to go to the hospital, but you can talk about it. I just don't want people to think that if you begin to have a conversation or you are worried about a friend, a family member, a loved one who is perhaps thinking about ending their lives, that by mentioning it or saying it, talking about suicide, that that's what they're going to go do. Quite the opposite. A lot of times people say, well, if a person is really at that point where they're going to end their lives, well, nothing is going to stop him or her, right? No. The studies have shown us that the vast majority of people who end up either attempting or are thinking about it are depressed, are sad. They've got an emotional illness. And being able to talk to someone, to just acknowledge their existence in some small way. I have had people that have come to my office as patients, and a stranger who has smiled at them or opened a door or said hello to them at the store was all it took for them to stay alive. That has happened in my office, that conversation. We are all so important. We don't realize how powerful we are. We don't realize what an act of kindness, no matter how small you think it is, could literally impact the life of another human being. I'm not saying stop what you're doing and just go out and meet and greet people. But how often are we stuck in our own minds, in our own phones, in our own tablets, in our own computers, that we don't even see other people? I'm not disparaging technology, but when we talk about these larger issues, the answer doesn't have to be so convoluted and complex about how we tackle them. The simple things that we can do to acknowledge another human being is an important first step. It could be very, very powerful. In the case of some of my patients, it was the reason, that small thing, that they're still alive. You have that power. I did a little bit of research, and I want to share this with you. It was a study that was done in 2007, and it took a look at the stigma that's associated with mental illness. And the details of the study aren't that critical. It's called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. But anyway, the bulk of it, and I just want to share a few of the results that really give you an idea at the level of stigma that is still out there. The results of the study were pretty interesting. Whether you had an emotional illness or you didn't, both sets of individuals agreed that treatment can really help people with mental illness to live normal lives. If you've got an illness or not, it makes sense. Yes, treatment of mental illness helps people. 57% of all adults in this study believed that in general, people are caring and sympathetic to persons with mental illness. But only 25% of those individuals in the study with mental health symptoms felt or believed that people are caring and sympathetic about those with mental illness. We have a long way to go. If you're depressed, do not be ashamed. Do not be embarrassed. This is nothing to be ashamed of. And I don't say this to be all syrupy, but you are so strong. It is why I am so enthused every single day at work, because people have depression, have anxiety, have bipolar or substance abuse, and they carve out a life. Families, careers, relationships, they carry a huge load. You carry a huge load, and you carve out your days. Who's stronger, the person who can make it through when things are going well, or the person who has the grace and the dignity to dare to carve out their lives with the weight of these emotional illnesses? You are not weak. You are not weak. Don't ever think that, and don't ever let this culture or anyone make you feel that way. To the rest, we have to do more. We have to talk to each other. We have to rethink what we know about emotional illness. We have to realize the advances that have happened over the last 30, 40 years. The scientific advances, the understanding of the brain, the treatment of it, the pharmaceutical treatment, the psychotherapy treatment, the holistic treatment that goes into improving a person's mental health and well-being. It's time to get out of the dark ages. We have made huge, huge progress in the last 30 years, but there's a long way to go. And time isn't on our side because there are consequences to the stigma. Stigma kills, whether it's in the form of suicide or the additional burden that it adds to long-term diseases that end up killing us. We are all so very strong. Don't doubt how powerful you are. If you remember nothing out of all of this, it is really that particular statement. It is the essence of everything the healthy mind is all about. And now it's time for news. Okay, well, wow, what a busy, busy few weeks for news. This first story really blew me away. You've probably heard about it in the news, but the headline, "Can Tylenol cause ADHD? Tylenol, acetaminophen. A new study out of UCLA found that acetaminophen use, it's the ingredient that's in Tylenol and Excedrin and a host of other products, but acetaminophen use by women during pregnancy is associated with a higher risk of ADHD in their children. Amazing. It is ubiquitous everywhere in our culture these over-the-counter pain relievers, particularly acetaminophen, Tylenol products, because they're easy on the stomach, they don't have as many side effects. But this long-term study out of UCLA really has raised concerns about the use of acetaminophen, especially during pregnancy. Now, according to Dr. Beat Ritz, a UCLA professor and one of the senior authors of this paper, he stated, quote, "The causes of ADHD and hyperkinetic disorder, which is a severe form of ADHD, are not well understood, but both environmental and genetic factors clearly contribute. We know there has been a rapid increase in childhood neurodevelopmental disorders, including ADHD, over the past decades. And it's likely that the rise is not solely attributable to better diagnosis or parental awareness. It's likely there are environmental components as well." End of quotes. Now, what the team did based on that was to try to find out what are some of these environmental components, these causes. And of particular interest to this team was pregnancy, where the fetus is developing, it's particularly vulnerable. And because Tylenol or acetaminophen is seen as so safe during pregnancy as a medication for pain, they thought they would look at it. And what they did was they studied over 60,000 Danish children and their mothers. So it was a combined study between UCLA and the Danish University of Aarhus. And the findings were pretty stunning. They were rather ominous. More than half of the mothers reported using acetaminophen when they were pregnant. And what they found was that the children whose mothers used acetaminophen during pregnancy were anywhere between a 13 to 37% higher risk of having ADHD-like behaviors at age 7. 13 to 37% higher risk. And the longer the acetaminophen was taken, say it goes into the second and third trimesters, the stronger the associations. The risk of ADHD in children were elevated 50% or more when mothers had used acetaminophen for more than 20 weeks in pregnancy. I'm going to say this again because it's really important for that fact. The risk of ADHD in children was elevated 50% or more when mothers used this painkiller for more than 20 weeks in their pregnancy. Now, why would it do this? Why would acetaminophen cause this? What's going on? What is so toxic about it? And according to the researchers, they felt, and they're going from animal data, but that acetaminophen, in addition to being a painkiller, is a hormone disruptor. And it was felt that abnormal hormone exposures in pregnancy may affect the way that the fetal brain develops. Now, it was an initial study. Of course, more research needs to be done, but you can bet based on these findings that it is going to be done. And if further research replicates these findings or finds another link, well, I think it will really raise the question of, is acetaminophen really a safe drug to take by women during pregnancy? Acetaminophen's role in causing ADHD. Just stunning. Okay, now our next story. Hey, I'm a parent. I have 3 children, 4, 2, and 1. So please don't say that I don't know what's going on. But, you know, parents really, we love to read to our kids. Parents think that by reading to kids early, especially when they're babies, they're going to learn to read. Well, the headline, "Can Babies Learn to Read?" And the results of this New York University study? No, babies can't learn to read. Now, you know, we do our best as parents, but these researchers looked at this and found that there was no real consistent finding that reading to our kids when they are babies is going to make them be able to actually read while they are so young. Dr. Susan Newman of New York University and the lead author said this, quote, "While we cannot say with full assurance that infants at this age cannot learn printed words, our results make clear they did not learn printed words from the baby media product that was tested." That was really actually very kind. Now, parents, don't despair. The researchers found there was an undeniable effect of these products, of books and the like, not on the babies, but on us, the parents. In the exit interviews to the study, there was the belief among parents that their babies were learning to read and that their children had benefited from the program in some areas of vocabulary development. It's a great little study, about 117 infants and their parents. They took a look through different types of media, whether it was DVDs, word and picture flashcards, and flip books over a 7-month period. But there really wasn't any association, not one, that infants could start reading. The only assessment that showed a difference was the parents' belief that their child was learning. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, parents. Believe me, I'm really sorry to give this news. I just think of the voluminous hours that we have spent reading to our kids. Now, you know, despite these results and my surprise at the findings, I don't care. I'm still going to read to my 1-year-old daughter, Catherine. And, you know, I'm still doing it, and I think she's picking up the words. So I'm going on record as being a skeptic, despite the science.
Okay, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines.
Okay, the first headline. Study uncovers why almost winning is just as good for some gamblers. A new study led by the University of Exeter and Swansea University has pinpointed the changes in the brain that lead gamblers to react in the same way to near misses as they do to winning in games of chance. How about that? Almost winning. The next headline. Scientists identify the switch that says it's time to sleep. The switch in the brain that sends us off to sleep has been identified in a brand new study by researchers at Oxford University. And finally, the headline. When faced with a hard decision, well, we tend to blame fate. A new study has found that we tend to deal with difficult decisions by shifting responsibility for the decision to fate, according to this study that was recently published in Psychological Science. What do you think? I sound like you? I have to admit, I see myself in that hard decision, leave it up to fate or destiny. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that just about does it for this week's episode of the Healthy Mind Podcast with Dr. Zafiridis. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the podcast. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Great ways that you can support me. Subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. We're on iTunes. Just put in the Healthy Mind or my last name at the search bar, Zafiridis, and you will get my podcast. Subscribe to it. Thanks for sharing it on Facebook and Twitter with your friends. Tell people about the podcast. It's a great way to get the reach going. If you've got a chance to rate on iTunes, I would so much appreciate it. You have no idea what a few ratings does to the reach of the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis. And any questions, comments, do not hesitate to get in touch with me. That's Peter at thehealthymind.com. Peter at thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, we are almost to episode 100. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.